Okay.
Whenever you're ready, Esther. Good morning, everyone. This is Julie Fedorchak, Chairman of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We are gathered on the 12th floor of the State Capitol for our regularly scheduled meeting. Today is Wednesday, September 21st, and I'll call this meeting to order. We have a pretty light agenda today, I would say, so I'll take a minute to provide some opening comments on an announcement of sorts that will be followed up later today with a news release. But I wanted to take a minute today to announce that the state's rail safety program has reached another milestone, an important milestone. Both of our inspectors are now certified to inspect independently. Our mechanical inspector received certification by the FRA to inspect on his own in August, and we just hadn't had a chance to put everything together and make that announcement to all of you yet. But so that makes both of them certified to inspect independently, really just over a year after we launched the program, which I think is a pretty noteworthy accomplishment. When we talked about this program, we, you know, walked through how long it might take, and I think we said 12 to 18 months before both were certified, and so we are on mark and in some respects even early in accomplishing that. And that is a credit both to Daryl Nitschke, our manager, who went to work real quickly in advertising and hiring those folks. We were able to hire some very good, qualified inspectors who are really diligent workers, and were serious about getting the inspection program completed in a timely manner, and did so. And now they are out inspecting both independently on their own. I took the day on Monday to travel with them and do an inspection with them in Max on Monday. And it was very enlightening to be out there on the rails with them looking at the system. The one thing that I didn't anticipate was how careful they need to be when they're busy doing their work to be aware of what's happening around them, because these are active tracks. So you could get totally distracted by what you're doing, what you're looking at, and a train could literally sneak up on you. You can't hear trains coming on that continuous welded rail that well, and because the thump, thump, thump isn't as prominent. And so they are very cautious of those types of safety issues. Just being out there on the track, there's a lot of different safety protocols they have to follow just being on the track and out there within the system of the cars. Also, when Eric is inspecting the cars, a lot of these trains are hooked up. You know, they might be 100 cars in a train. He doesn't necessarily see the beginning of the train, and he doesn't know if it's hooked up to a locomotive or not. So he has to be very careful when he's even inspecting the cars. You know, they have to get down and under and look, and he has to be conscious of the fact that those trains could start moving at any point. So it's not without risk. I will just say that the actual job itself is not without risk. So I have a new appreciation for that. And I also have a new appreciation for how important it is to have these inspectors out there. The system is so complicated. There are so many literally moving parts when you look at the actual rail cars themselves, from the wheels to the brakes to the connectors where they connect the whole trains. All of these pieces and components could lead in just a small way. A small defect could become a significant problem in short order and could lead to a derailment. And that's what we're out there trying to avoid. So these folks don't really leave any stone unturned. They're looking at everything from, you know, little pins that aren't supposed to be in place to the bigger issues such as a cracked wheel or a significant problem with a switch in the track or in the track itself, the bed of the track, and everything else. So it's a good program. I'm very comfortable with where we are. I think that this program is paying dividends to North Dakota already, to North Dakotans, because this just increases the third-party independent oversight of our rail system in North Dakota. The rail system is vital to our economy, and it runs through the center of almost every North Dakota community as well. So it's really important that it works safely, both for the efficiency of the system, so it can deliver product on time and be reliable for the folks that are using it, but also for the safety of the citizens who are living really close to these tracks in most places. So quite pleased with how the program has expanded. We are focusing on energy routes for the track, so that's where Carl is focusing most of his time is on the energy routes where you have the most hazardous material being transported. And Eric is focusing on compliance in terms of the mechanical side of things, making sure that the rail companies are focused on compliance with the standards as they exist. One of the areas that he's found a lot of room, I don't want to say room for improvement, but probably the greatest number of defects, which are the lesser severe type of problem, is in the safety equipment devices on the cars themselves. And these are intended to make it safe for the workers who are working on the system and on the railroads. And, you know, handholds, et cetera, like that, when you're standing on really not the most flat ground and rocky ground and on level, those handholds are vital. And if they're not, you know, screwed in correctly and tightly, or they're loose, it can lead to an accident with the workers out there and or jumping between cars and that sort of thing. So Eric is really focused not only on the actual challenges and the safety issues of the cars themselves so that they don't derail, but also on improvements that can be made so that it's safer for the workers themselves. So all in all, it's a good program. We'll have a news release going out later today that sort of summarizes some of the program's findings so far, but just wanted to make that announcement here at the front end of the meeting this morning. The other thing that it brought to mind was looking at the complicated nature of the tanker cars for transporting crude oil. Obviously, there's been a lot of improvements to make that safer, and I think that there has been, you know, valiant efforts to make crude by rail as safe as possible. But it still remains that putting crude oil in a steel pipe buried 4 feet below the ground, transporting 1,000 miles without really coming into contact with any outside force is much safer than putting it on a rail car that's subject to weather conditions and just mechanical challenges both with the rail and the cars itself. And so it just brought home to me again that while we're working to make that as safe as possible, and there's been significant improvements, and it can be done safely almost a majority of the time, it's not as safe as pipelines. So we still need to, you know, focus on the pipeline solution as well as the best, safest, most environmentally sound method for transporting crude oil. So that concludes my opening comments. Commissioner Crisman.
Well, for a moment there, I thought that in the interest of safety, you were going to call on the rail industry to return to the old coal-fired locomotives as you could hear them chugging along. Make sure they didn't sneak up on any workers.
That was a quote from the inspectors. They can sneak up on you.
It is a real thing, though. You get to focus on your work, and I'm glad they're focused on safety.
Yeah.
I spent yesterday at the North Dakota Petroleum Council meeting in Minot, and some interesting conversations both with people who we pretty directly work with as well as others who are more indirectly impacted by our work. And it's an interesting time up there. First of all, I hear a lot of concern from people who reflecting on what has happened in the last couple of weeks on Dakota Access, are concerned about what the word of the government means when a permit is issued. And if there's been no violations or nothing found to be being constructed in a way different than what it was planned, that all of a sudden the permit can just be pulled, and it really leaves people in limbo on making major investment of millions or even billions of dollars. So that certainly, I think, has a real negative impact on the industry's thought processes right now. The flip side, though, is kind of an amazing bunch of people in that, you know, prices can be terrible for them, where they're literally losing money on pretty much every well. And it seems like the government's working against them, and everything just about is going negative for them, and they're looking at what they can do to cut drilling times and create efficiencies and looking out into the future and planning to move ahead. So they do seem like a really resilient type of entrepreneurs. And so it's going to be some interesting times in our country right now, and a lot of it hinges on actions going on right here in North Dakota. So found it to be a very interesting day, and that concludes my opening comments.
Thank you, Randy. Commissioner Culk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The I can't pass up the chance. I know we all three are thinking about it, but those that haven't heard, Jim Deutsch has decided he's going to retire. After 42 years at the PSC, he's announced that end of November he's going to retire, and I encourage all my members and colleagues of the media, not colleagues, I guess, members of the media. Jim was around when the North Dakota rules were put into place that were adopted by the state and eventually the federal government. And if there's this is the fact, if there's one guy that could really be credited for North Dakota's rules and the federal rules, Jim's the guy. And so, Jim, I know we're planning a big hoopla for you going away, and I know it's a couple months down the road and we got a lot of decisions to make and there'll be a big hole left upstairs, but I'm excited about the next phase of your chapter of your life. And Esther tells me we're going to have a big shindig. So anyway, so Jim, thanks, and we'll be more to follow on that. But I wanted to make sure everybody knew since Jim told the commissioners on whatever day it was. So thank you, Jim.
You can be assured, Jim, since we're doing the cooking tonight for the PSC Fall Festival, you won't have to be subject to our cooking at your own going away party. We'll get that out of the way.
Although, Jim, I have to tell you that I did receive a phone call from your wife, and she asked if there was a way that I could keep you working, we could keep you working longer, and we said, no, it's your choice, Jim, so I'm not sure if you cleared all the paths yet. All right, thanks. The only thing I have to offer, that I guess, on opening comments is last week I was out in St. Paul for the MISO, I won't say it's their annual meeting, but it's MISO's annual meeting, and I go to these meetings from time to time about, you know, what's going on with the power grid, not only in North Dakota but in our region. And we, the three of us, have been talking a lot about concerns about retirement and baseload generation, but MISO has been very much always, listen, there's plenty of power out there, no worries, no worries, no worries. But this time, for the first time since I've been doing this, MISO has announced that some of their states are projected to be short on power in 2017. So that's pretty big news. What it comes down to is I'm looking at that recently announced retirements have decreased the excess overall for the MISO region down to 0.7% is all the excess power they have projected for 2017, and some states are projected to be deficient. You know, the supply has declined due to plant retirements, not only coal, but some major nuclear retirements out in Illinois and Michigan areas. And one thing that I thought was the most fascinating there was when I talked with the MISO individuals about, okay, listen, aren't you concerned about some of these states being deficient? And they said, well, listen, our job is to tell people they're deficient. It's not our job to fix the problem. That's the state's job. And so it's interesting that depending what groups you have, they rely on MISO to give them the forecast. But as soon as MISO's forecast comes out where there might be a deficiency, they pass the buck right back to the state saying, well, we're just telling you you're deficient. It's the state's responsibility to make sure there's enough power. And the states, quite honestly, according to the MISO survey, that are projected to be deficient are Missouri, Illinois, and parts of Michigan. And so North Dakota is not projected to be deficient, but we're down to basically a 1% quote-unquote excess. And there's a lot of ways those numbers can be projected and turned around. But the point to me is that MISO has now finally said that we, MISO, are deficient in power. And you know what? They wash their hands of it. They say it's back to the states to make sure that there's enough power. So then I pushed the question to them. I said, okay, we regulate Otter Tail, XL, and MDU, so we can have a role in that. But we don't regulate, nor do I want to, you know, your big GNTs, your Basin Electrics of the world, your Minn Kotas of the world, your Great River Energy. So how can you, how is a state responsible for this when we don't regulate those things? And they pointed out to me that several states have a requirement that their major generators, before they decide to shut something down, they have to notify the PSC in a timely manner where the PSC can then weigh in. Not an announcement at 4 o'clock that they've already decided to shut the plant down. So one of the things that I haven't even talked to my colleagues about this, one of the things that I'm going to pursue for this next session is to see if we can get some legislation that basically says the PSC does not want to regulate, you know, the co-ops, large GNTs, but the GNTs need to notify us in a timely manner when they want to retire their major generating plants. And so we, the ones who are held to have the reliability, can have a role in this. Now, I understand that's going to be it'll be a discussion with my colleagues. Like I said, I haven't had a chance to talk to them about it. But I think it's the right thing to do, because when MISO comes out and says the region is short of power, then they wash their hands of it and say, well, now states, it's up to you to make sure you have enough power. Well, how are we supposed to do that if we're not at the table with the discussion on the larger GNTs about what they're doing going forward? I know they file IRPs, but those tend to change quite a bit. So I think this is going to continue to be a very large point for discussion, because, you know, it's interesting. MISO now is finally flipped with enough power in the region, and there are no major generating plants scheduled to be built in the MISO region, but there are lots of generating plants scheduled to be retired. So this is not going to get better for the MISO region. And I would also say on the western area, Southwest Power Pool is not a lot different. So I think the big thing for North Dakota customers is North Dakota, we're sitting okay right now. The larger region of MISO, there's some concerns. I spent a lot of time talking with Commissioner Talberg out of Michigan, and she's very concerned about what's going on in her state, because they're trying to get their industry going back. They're short on power, and the power they do have, the costs are going up, so they don't see a good solution out there. So anyway, it was very telling. I look forward to the next time we talk about legislation with my colleagues on that. But I do think we are also sitting in a potential where we can build more baseload generation and renewables and offer it up to the MISO market to be part of their solution. So that might be the win-win for North Dakota, that if we can get the transmission built, the baseload and renewables on the grid, that we can become not only a number of exporter we are now, we can grow that export potential to get more resources coming to our state for our energy-rich state. So that's my story, Commissioner.
Excellent. Thank you for covering that meeting.
I was deferring to you, but quite a power display on Saturday.
Oh, you're referring to the North Dakota State victory over number 13, Iowa. Now we're ranked number 27 in the country nationally over all power. Iowa. Thank you.
That's what I was referring to.
Okay, thank you.
You'll know it's a big accomplishment when even my husband, who is not a diehard Bison fan, said, you got to hand it to him. They beat Iowa.
It was fun.
That is very noteworthy.
University of North Dakota won double overtime this weekend, too, I see.
Yep, very good.
And just so you know, Commissioner Nick Wagner and I attended the game in Iowa, and we had quite a good time, and North Dakota won that rights, too. So.
Good. What did you guys bet?
One soda.
Oh. All righty. Okay, that concludes our opening comments. I'd be happy to talk more about the rail stuff at the end, too, if there's questions on that. But let me get out the consent stuff. We have a number of items on consent. I move passage of those items.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to further discussion. Since seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. All right, moving on to the regular agenda. I have one item. It's a pipeline. I move the commission deem complete the application for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit, and further move the commission issue a notice of filings and public hearing in Epping Transmission Company, LLC, 12.75-inch crude oil pipeline, Williams County, citing application case number PU-16-614.
Second.
The Epping Transmission Company has filed applications for this Certificate of Corridor Compatibility and Route Permit for this 3.2-mile, 12.75-inch diameter, and 0.2 miles of 8-inch transmission crude oil line and facilities in Williams County. This is essentially another connecting pipeline to the Dakota Access System. This we have been in the past doing having administrative law judges, substantive ALJs, handle hearings of this nature that are a little bit shorter. But this one is a little longer than the 1 mile, 1.5 mile that some of those have been, or 2 mile. This is 3.2. And it also comes fairly close to the community of Epping and has a variety of avoidance areas sort of in the corridor. So I am recommending that we participate in this hearing ourselves, and we'll be scheduling a date and time for that hearing in the admin portion of the meeting. But basically, this is a line that it connects the Epping station and the existing Divide main line, which is owned by the same company, to the Dakota Access Pipeline's Epping tank farm or facility that will have the capacity for 30,000 barrels per day. And the company noted in the application that that would translate to approximately 168 trucks per day that could be eliminated versus using the pipeline. So we'll set the hearing for this in the admin portion of the meeting, and it's another connector. Julie, does this make four or five of these little connectors that we're seeing? We've seen a number of these smaller pipelines being proposed and developed to connect other transmission systems to the larger export transmission system of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and I expect that we'll continue to do so. But I would, rough math, I think this is the fifth one that we've seen. We could confirm that. Okay.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Just to offer on the way in, I stopped by Julie Prescott's office, and it looks like November 22nd might be the date that has been cleared by all three of us. Just is that right, JP? Okay.
Okay, so it'll be November 22nd in Williston at 10 a.m.? 9 a.m. All righty.
Is that the birthplace of Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk?
It is. Always fun to get up there.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion approved.
All right. Thank you, Daryl. That concludes my portfolio. Commissioner Chrisman.
Which hospital in Epping were you born at?
Not Epping.
Okay.
It would have been the Catholic hospital.
Okay, RC1. I move the commission present the 2016 North Dakota Award for Excellence in Surface Coal Mining and Reclamation to the Coteau Properties Company.
Second.
The PSC's State Reclamation Award Program sets out the criteria for presenting a reclamation award at the Lignite Energy Council's annual meeting. And while the annual meeting is now held in the spring instead of the fall like it used to be, LE staff would like to present this year's award at its fall conference scheduled for October 5th and 6th at the Ramp Dakota Hotel. So we will have a press release probably more in that time frame when we actually present this. I'm not sure if it'll be the 5th or the 6th yet. The Reclamation Division does recommend that Coteau be recognized for hydrologic reclamation projects that included the early removal and reclamation of many sedimentation ponds and construction of post-mining stock ponds and wetlands. And for listeners or viewers who don't work with this stuff regularly, a sedimentation pond is much different than a stock pond or a wetland. The sedimentation ponds are used while there's activity there, catches all the water flow coming across disturbed areas of the mine and allows any soil that was picked up by the waters to settle out and not flow out of the mine site. It's constructed differently. You don't just leave those and they become stock ponds later. They have to be reclaimed. Stock ponds are built in a different way near the end of the reclamation process and designed specifically for stock ponds. Wetlands are a third animal of their own and are designed differently and have eco values of their own. So Coteau's reclamation efforts involved the removal and reclamation of 33 sedimentation ponds from 2012 through 2015, including two very large impoundments that were also regulated by the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. In addition, Coteau constructed 11 stock ponds and four wetlands in the post-mining landscape during this time period. The successful completion of this list of reclamation projects was a significant achievement and made use of approved alternative sediment controls to accelerate the pond reclamation process. The early reclamation of these sedimentation ponds may result in a more timely bond release of the reclaimed lands in the future. Extensive planning was required for this detailed process. Coteau had to submit their removal and reclamation plans for each structure for approval by our Reclamation Division and the State Health Department prior to starting the reclamation. And since the surrounding mine lands had already been reclaimed, these removal plans had to include specific plans for pond access via either established or temporary roads and whether alternative sediment controls are to be incorporated. This process was repeated numerous times in order to reclaim all 33 sedimentation ponds. Construction of post-mining stock ponds and wetlands also required detailed planning and the scheduling of field operations. Design information was typically submitted as a permit revision for staff review and approval, and the approvals were needed in a timely manner, and certainly this award is going to Coteau, but our reclamation team deserves a lot of credit for the extra work involved as well and doing it so quickly. Coteau took extraordinary efforts to plan, schedule, and reclaim the final projects. The collective time, skills, and resources expended by engineers, environmental specialists, planners, operations supervisors, and equipment operators to complete these reclamation projects on schedule was significant. So staff believes that Coteau's reclamation efforts over the four-year period is worthy of this year's Staff Reclamation Award, and I couldn't agree more.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
And just to reiterate, we'll have a press release will go out, and this will actually be awarded to Coteau on either October 5th or October 6th at the Ramcota at the LEC's fall conference. RC2, I move the commission close out contract number AM757-16 with BNC Concrete Pumping Incorporated for completion of drilling and grouting, and close out contract number AM758-16 with GeoServe Incorporated for completion of material testing services, both for the 2016 Wilton Phase 2 AML project.
Second.
On May 18th, we entered into contracts with BNC Concrete Pumping Incorporated and GeoServe Incorporated for this Wilton Phase 2 AML project. The project involved rotary drilling to locate underground mine voids and the injection of pressurized grout into underground voids beneath public roads in northern Burley County, kind of just southeast of Wilton. The total cost under the drilling and grouting project was $1.377 million, which is $138,000 more than the original contract amount, and that's about 11%. Staff issued four change orders to increase the amounts of drilling, casing, and grout, which is why it came in over the original budget. But at a special meeting on July 27th, the commission approved an additional $198,600 for the additional work. So the drilling and grouting work began on June 6th, and final cleanup was completed on August 22nd. The original contract with GeoServe for the testing was in the amount of just a hair under $44,000. The final cost for the material testing services was $44,119. So it's about 0.31% over, and there was the additional testing work done as part of that. One change order was written to increase the number of samples tested. Joan Briner supervised this project, and the work of both contractors was completed to her satisfaction, And our seasonal inspector, Alan Erickson, was also on site for most of the project. The final invoices have been submitted and paid, so the contracts can now be closed out.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
RC3, I move the commission adopt the order on certifying use of Federal Universal Services Support and Public Service Commission USF Use Certification 47 CFR 54.314 of 2017, compliance case number PU-16-532.
Second.
Should be pretty understandable just from the motion, isn't it?
But I
can go into a little more explanation, I guess. Federal regulations require that states that desire eligible telecommunication carriers to receive support pursuant to the high-cost program must file an annual certification with the administrator and with the FCC, stating that all federal high-cost support provided to these carriers within the state was used in the preceding calendar year and will be used in the coming calendar year only for the provision, maintenance, and upgrading of facilities and services for which the support is intended, and that state certification must be filed no later than October 1st of each year. On October 28th of 2002, just over 14 years ago now, the PSC issued an order indicating that any telecommunications carrier providing local exchange service that desires to have our certification to the FCC shall file an affidavit by September 14th of each year certifying that the federal support they receive is used as intended. The PSC further ordered that affidavits filed will be the basis of the PSC's certification to the FCC. The FCC, in its order, recognized that some states have only limited regulatory oversight and concluded that such states may nonetheless certify to the FCC that the carriers in the state had accounted to the State Commission for receipt of federal support and the support will be used as required. The FCC also recognized that some carriers may not be subject to jurisdiction of a state regulatory authority, and in those instances, the carriers can certify directly to the FCC simply by means of a sworn affidavit executed by a corporate officer. We have 42 carriers in the state that have certified to us by the deadline that they meet the requirements of the FCC, and so this order will get that message to the FCC, and they should be able to continue receiving universal service support.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I would just maybe add that there's still, I think, robust debate that's kind of been tabled out in D.C. about the future of USF dollars going to the state. They're transitioning potentially to the Connect America Fund, and how much that might be funded is still something to change. And I know a few years ago we heard a lot from some of the North Dakota companies worried about the future of USF, and we told them, we said, maybe it's time to start adjusting your business model where you're less reliant on those USF dollars. So everything in today's order, I think, is very appropriate, and we're doing all the things we're supposed to, but it's still, there is a backstory out there about federal support to different telecommunication companies, and I think that with more and more ways to communicate and more devices out there, our regulatory touch is going to continue to become softer and softer, and I think that's the right approach. But for right now, we got to keep playing the hand that's been dealt.
I have one question on this, and it's more of a process issue than anything real substantive, but since we're just certifying that they filed an affidavit with us, why don't they just file an affidavit with the FCC and leave us out of it? Is that an option, Pat?
It is an option, but the companies, the FCC likes to rely on the state for that certification, and they like us to do that, to go through that process. And so I think they prefer for the states to do it, but the companies could do it directly to the FCC if they wanted to.
They like it because they want us to do all the paperwork.
That's right, Commissioner.
I
remember 4 years ago having the same discussion with Pat, and it's the FCC does not respect state jurisdiction sometimes, but yet when it comes time for the paperwork for them to do things, they always rely on us to do their bidding, if you will.
But
well, yeah. And then it's a little bit more of a buffer for them, too, that they can blame us if something's wrong.
And they like to keep states engaged in processes as well.
Is there a benefit for us doing it? I mean, having that touch with these companies, and what do we gain by keeping this?
Well, I think every year then we get an idea of the companies that are continuing to receive universal service funding. It's like an update for us on new companies that are asking for universal service funding as well.
If a company just failed to do this by accident or something, or was going out of business and wasn't getting the job done, this is how we would know that there's an area of the state that may not be served with proper telecommunications. So I think it's kind of important in that loop. And also, if we didn't choose to do this, then we would, I imagine, the FCC would no longer recognize us probably then as the ones who certify whether people are ETC eligible, and I'd hate to give that up.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
And lastly, RC4, I move the Commission adopt an order in case number GE-16-612 granting the request of Hanson Mueller Company or Corporation? Company of Omaha, Nebraska to operate as a roving grain buyer in North Dakota.
Second.
Hanson Mueller Company is a foreign business corporation originated in Nebraska and is registered in good standing with the North Dakota Secretary of State. They began as a commodity trading company and expanded into country elevator operations, feed grain processing, and bulk commodity logistics. They project purchasing 500,000 bushels of grain annually in North Dakota and filed a corresponding $250,000 surety bond. They notified the commission. They have not transacted business as a roving grain buyer in the state. Statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends a license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio.
Thank you, Randy. Commissioner Christman? Commissioner Cox, sorry.
Randy? Randy, I usually give us some trivia, so I thought perhaps you were going to tell us that Omaha, Nebraska, where this last roving grain buyer came out of, is also the birthplace of NDSU quarterback Easton Stick, but since you didn't bring that up, I wanted to tell it.
Didn't want to make a slight to NDSU wide receiver R.J. Erzendowski.
He's also from Omaha. We plan this out, Dave.
This is getting gross.
All righty then, item BK1. I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing and reduce the filing fee to $10,000 in Otter Tail Power Company's transmission facility cost recovery 2017 rates, case number PU16624.
Second.
Thank you, Randy. In September of this year, Otter Tail filed an annual update to its transmission facility cost recovery rider tariff. Basically, the tariff that they're requesting for this next year actually is a reduction in what they've anticipated by quite a significant amount. And I want to spend a couple minutes. All this does today is set the notice opportunity for hearing, and anyone requesting a hearing must do so by November 7th of 2016. If someone doesn't request a hearing, then we'll, of course, have an informal. But one of the things I wanted to, and certainly not going to try to try this case right now, but when we see these riders come in, I've been critical of riders in the past because sometimes I don't think they do the things we need them to do it. But in this case, the transmission riders, I've always felt, are very good. They give us a true up of transmission costs. And there's a lot of fluctuation right now in the transmission world, as I talked about in my opening comments. But in this case, Otter Tail proposes to reduce its rates by $2.6 million from one year to the next. And that's quite a significant decrease. And basically, the cost for that, the cause of that decrease is the SPP charges are less than they anticipated for 2016. Otter Tail and SPP's relationship is new. They weren't really sure what those costs would be, so they went on the high side, which I think is correct. The bonus tax depreciation, which we've talked about in previous cases, was passed in December of 2015, had a big impact on these transmission lines costs. And finally, the MISO ROE was less than what they thought it would be because of some complaints against FERC. But the long and short of this is, as we look at this case, I want to make sure we make it clear that the company is saying that they need $2.6 million less this next year, and they've offered to kind of spread that reduction over the next couple years, because the next year, 2018, they're anticipating costs for a lot of the transmission build-out to be coming in, so there'd be a potentially a decrease of, you know, almost, you know, $2.5 million, and the next year put it back up again. So they've offered to spread this out a little bit, and I think that's certainly good. But one thing I'll throw out to the company or anybody listening, there's also a lot of unknowns. There's a current litigation in front of FERC that North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota are part of with Otter Tail in front of FERC about the transmission costs that are finalized by SPP. So as we get into this case, it's going, I think, going to be a lot of other factors that come into play, because there's a lot of uncertainty about transmission costs. And so I'm glad to see Otter Tail is really doing, I think, a nice job of tracking these costs. There's a potential to hold this cost of transmission equal for a couple years, even reduce it along the way. But I just wanted to put out there, I don't think this is a layup by any means, that it's going to be a decrease of a couple dollars per month for a 1,000-megawatt customer, because I think I'm going to want to bring in more things to this, because there's a lot of uncertainty of what these costs are going to be. And hopefully by the time we get to the informal or the hearing, we can flush out some of those details. But certainly everything's in order for the announcement today. And I thank Otter Tail for putting this together, and look forward to either the hearing or the informal.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
As I was looking through this in advance of the meeting, I thought that between Otter Tail and our staff, however this all came together, there was really some nice work here. To, you know, you can't spread that out over too long, or you don't have, it's not, it's, it can be a significantly different customer base. But at least just spreading it over a couple years here, I think prevents some big fluctuations, and I think they did a nice job on this.
Well, and it hasn't been decided yet. We're just
not
looking
at all.
At it, right?
Correct, and I just wanted to put that out to the company, things that are going to come into this more than just perhaps we're seeing right here, because in stuff I'm involved in, there's a lot of uncertainty that if we have an opportunity to hold these lines and some other, that could help in other areas, will be, I'd like to explore those when we get to either the informal or the hearing.
Mm-hmm. Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Item BK2. I move the commission assess a filing fee of $10,000 and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing an Otter Tail Power Company's 416 and 12.5 kV Rugby Project Public Convenience and Necessity, case number PU16625.
Second.
Thank you. And in September of this year, Otter Tail filed an application for Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity to construct two parallel 416 kV transmission lines in approximately a half mile in length, and two 12.5 kV lines approximately a half mile and 1.2 miles in length, and make updates to the Otter Tail's existing substation in Rugby. Anyone requesting a hearing must do so by October 31st of this year. If not, the commission can do this in an informal. And in this particular case, I think it does tie to the previous case, because this is one of those projects that Otter Tail feels it'll be in the best long-term interest of them, because by building these lines, adding up to the substation will make them less reliant on some of the services they've received from Central Power. And Central Power now is, of course, an SPP member. So one of the things that will come out here, I think Otter Tail believes in their filing, that it's better for them to sever some of these relationships with SPP and build their own. So going forward, they have the cost that they can control themselves, as well as it will shore up some of the transmission needs in that part of the state. So I do think, from what I've seen so far, this looks like a good discussion we're going to have forward. And Otter Tail is certainly, I think, really spending a lot of time looking at what transmission needs they need up in there, that part of the state, the north and northeast, as this SPP-MISO relationship finalizes itself. So I look forward to either the informal or the hearing on this project.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Daryl. And last but not least, item BK3. I move the Commission acknowledge the September 13, 2016 electronic submittal of the 2017 Gas Pipeline Safety Program Base Grant Application in the amount of $399,310 to the U.S. Department of Transportation Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or affectionately known as PHMSA, Washington, D.C., for the operation and management of the 2017 North Dakota Intrastate Gas Pipeline Safety Program, Public Service Commission 2017 Federal State Gas Pipeline Safety Grants and Contracts, case number GS16634.
Second.
Thank you, Pat, for that long, robust motion that let me use my enunciation skills. We put in the grant every year for the Natural Gas Safety Program with the state administers, and this is a very solid relationship. Every year we put in what we think it'll take to run the program. They come out and do the inspection of us, and based on how we do in the inspections, we usually get back some of that reimbursement. One thing that in the submittal lays out exactly what the cost will be for our inspectors, the two full-time, and Pat has part of his time is some of their travel costs. And so the way this lays out, we put in what we need, what we think we'll need. They'll come out and inspect us. We do get some reimbursement. And I think the key point I always like to say is that this is not a fully funded federal program. It takes roughly $400,000 to run the program, but you never get that full reimbursement back. So the state ends up putting in quite a bit of money to this. And I think that's the right relationship. But also, too, as we continue to look forward with what might be the funding uncertainty for different things in the federal level, whether it's coal projects or gas projects, I think we always have to be aware of what it takes to run these programs, because as we go into this next session where we're having some significant reductions in our budget, there's also some things that if you don't get the federal reimbursement in some of these areas, that'll have a big impact on our general funds. So everything's in order for this that we've already submitted. I'd just like to highlight the relationship between the federal and state funding.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
This is an area where I think it makes a lot of sense for the state to be involved. We have a lot of natural gas infrastructure in the state, and it's really nice to have the people who are overseeing it just down the hall and accountable and accessible to us and to others. They have a lot of expertise and a lot of hands-on knowledge about what's happening in these systems that have a lot of impact on the citizens. Most of the time, vast majority of the time, they just work without anybody even realizing they're there. But that's because you've got folks, working in tandem with industry to keep an eye on the safety of these systems. We've seen in recent months the difficulty that exists when citizens here and reporters can't get in touch with members of federal offices. They won't return calls. I'm speaking about the Corps of Engineers. I'm even speaking about PHMSA. It's really hard for people to get any response out of those agencies. And so I'd like to highlight the areas where the state is working in tandem with those agencies, inspecting to their standards, but also providing that in-state accountability and touch that I think is really valuable on these types of oversight programs.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Koch. All right. Well, that concludes the regular agenda and the consent agenda. Do we have any questions from the members of the media?
So again, just a very brief capsule. Why was the time in terms of getting both pipeline inspectors certified, why did it take less time?
Rail inspectors?
I'm sorry, rail
yes.
inspectors. Sorry about that.
Well, first of all, when we first set out, we were just looking at what other states typically used in terms of time for certifying their inspectors, and a lot of it depends on how much experience they show up with. And so it was a combination of we hired really qualified individuals who worked hard, knowing that we wanted this program up and running and delivering results to citizens in short order. And so they really put their nose to the grindstone and worked hard with those federal inspectors to check all the boxes and complete all that was required for the certification. And why that's important is that until they were certified, they were just working in tandem with the federal inspectors, so you really weren't getting more inspections in the state. Now today, you've really multiplied the amount of inspections that are occurring on the rail system because you have the FRA inspectors, plus now you have these two state inspectors who are out inspecting on their own.
So it's a word of it's a case of more eyes out there, good for everybody.
Absolutely. We've got more eyes and ears on the ground out there looking and working with the railroads to improve the safety culture and find additional ways to make the system more safe. We also, one of the big benefits that I like to mention because I think it's substantial, is that the state now has two folks who can walk the talk with the industry. This is a vital industry to citizens in North Dakota, to our business community, and we now have experts who can communicate with the rail industry, and they can go out when we have issues, citizens' complaints, and they can have some expertise to use in determining what the issues are and how to best solve them. That's a really valuable benefit to this program as well.
Quick refresher, how many federal ones usually are working in the state?
The federal has 2 to 3 track inspectors. They cover North Dakota and other areas. And they have one mechanical inspector that covers North Dakota and Montana. So we added one track and one mechanical. The track, they're covering 3,000 miles of track. And the mechanical areas, you know, they're covering all of the entire state looking at. And they focus, mechanical inspectors really focus more in the yards where the trains are parked.
Dave, to your question, I would just add, and Commissioner Fedorchak would never say this, but I'll say it, her leadership in this really helped. She worked hard. It's her portfolio, and I saw how often they were meeting in your office and how hard she worked with industry and others and the people to do it to make sure, because we have everything up here is a priority. But when commissioners put their influence and their weight behind certain programs at certain times, it really makes a big difference, and I know that Julie's worked hard on this, and I think it shows because the program has really gone from nothing to where it's at in a relatively short period of time.
Thank you, Brian.
That's not a reference of NDSU and UND, but it is a reference between I appreciate what you did here.
Thank you.
No, seriously, I know that everybody's got different areas they work on, but this is did a nice job on it.
I appreciate that. Thanks. It's been a team effort, so it's been productive so far, and I look forward to it continuing to delivering good results for our citizens. Anything else? Any other questions? All righty. Then we will adjourn briefly. What time is it? 11 o'clock?
11 o'clock.
Want to come back in at 10 after and wrap up? All righty. Thank you.